And it is my great pleasure to welcome tonight Professor Graham Virgo, who is the 2016 New Zealand Law Foundation Distinguished Visiting Fellow. This is a generous fellowship that the New Zealand Law Foundation provides to take turns hosting outstanding and distinguished international guests. And Otago has chosen Professor Virgo by unanimous applause at our staff meeting to come along and be the host for his visit throughout New Zealand. And he's here to lead today and be visiting all the universities in New Zealand while he's here. We also have the fortune of Graham tonight giving the 2016 FW Guest Lecture, so it's a doubly joyous occasion. As you'll know, the FW Guest Memorial Lecture is given annually to commemorate the work of the late Professor Frank Guest, and I see Jim Guest. Welcome, Jim, at the back there tonight. Professor Guest was the first professor of law at this university and the first full-time dean of the law faculty. There's a wonderful photo of Professor Guest in the library. You'll see a wonderful photo of him sitting there. We've been fortunate with the Guest Lecture to have a very high standard of outstanding individuals present the lecture, and Graham is a most fitting candidate to deliver the lecture tonight, and it gets published in the Otago Law Review. Just to tell you a wee bit about Professor Graham Virgo, he's a Professor of English Private Law in the Faculty of Law at the University of Cambridge, and has been a Fellow of Downing College since 1989, where he read law as an undergraduate. He went on to read for the BCL at Oxford, where he was awarded the Wynarian Scholarship, which is the top BCL student. He then read for the bar. Graham was senior tutor at Downing College between 2003 and 2013 and has also served as Director of Studies in Law. Graham is a venture of Lincoln's Inn and a door tenant at 24 Old Buildings. Graham received a Pilkington Prize for the University of Cambridge for excellence in teaching in 2002 and was a finalist for the Oxford University Press Law Teacher of the Year in 2013. Graham writes and researches in the fields of criminal law, good stuff, equity and trusts, and the law of restitution, and is published widely in these areas. Graham became Pro Vice Chancellor for Education at Cambridge in October 2014. That's education across the whole university, but he still teaches, and he still teaches as well as the ministers. In that capacity, he's overseen all aspects of education policy and strategy for undergraduate students, and also postgraduate students and part-time students, as well as libraries and sport. So it's my great pleasure tonight to invite Professor Graham Virgo, who is truly a world authority on equity, to speak to us tonight on a very important topic in our law, conscience and equity, a new utopia. Please give Professor Graham Virgo the biggest warm up. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that warm welcome, and it is a real pleasure to be here. It's an honour to be chosen by this law school who is hosting me while I'm on this visit to New Zealand. I'm really grateful for the support I've received back home to get me here and for the warm welcome I have received. I know a bit about the law school at the University of Otago. I've taught some students who've graduated from here and have come to Cambridge. And I've had some colleagues come to Cambridge and teach with me who've studied here. So I know what an exceptional law school it is. And it's a delight to be able to see that myself on this rather cold, rather wet evening and some weather that I'm completely used to from back home in England. Now, I'm going to be talking about conscience in equity, a new utopia. Conscience is something I have been thinking about quite hard for a number of years in my research and my writing about equity, because whenever you look at equity, the language of conscience and unconscionability keeps emerging. And I didn't really know what conscience and unconscionability actually means. So this paper and this presentation is an attempt and to reflect on what conscience and unconscionability might mean. The reference to a new utopia is actually a reference to Sir Thomas More's book, Utopia, which was published exactly 500 years ago. And in that book, Thomas More, a lawyer, identified an ideal world, which he called Utopia. And actually, when you read that book, you see an awful lot of discussion and examination of legal concepts, because his utopian world was certainly a world where the rule of law plays a vital part. And Thomas More considered equity to form a vital part of the rule of law. But before I go any further, I want to preface what I'm going to say with a sort of apology, because I want to give you a bit of substance and something to think about. And in the course of what I'm saying, I may be rather critical of some aspects of New Zealand law. And I want to apologise for that, because you've been so generous to me, and it's rather arrogant for an English lawyer to come here and say to you, well, maybe you're not quite getting it right. I will also say, if I was in England, and when I do teach in England and I do speak to judges and barristers in England, I say, have a look at what they're doing in New Zealand. Start reading the New Zealand cases. Consider what the judiciary are doing. There's an awful lot for English lawyers to learn from what goes on in New Zealand. But reflecting on utopia, there is a wonderful quotation that I thought I had to mention right at the start of my talk. Sir Thomas More says, and I think this is relevant to me standing in front of you, "You are not obliged to assault people with discourses that are out of their road when you see that their received notions must prevent your making an impression upon them. You ought rather to cast about and to manage things with all the dexterity in your power, so that if you are not able to make them go well, they may be as little ill as possible." So if this doesn't go well, I hope there is as little ill as possible. So let's move on and think about conscience and unconscionability. As I say, conscience is right at the heart of equity. It's conscience that justifies the equitable jurisdiction. And as I said earlier, I don't really know what conscience means. And my confusion about the meaning of conscience and unconscionability was exacerbated 3 years ago by two decisions of the UK Supreme Court that were handed down within 2 weeks of each other. And they exacerbated my confusion simply because justices in these two cases had completely different notions about what unconscionability means. The first is a case called Pitt and Holt, which essentially is about restitution in equity for mistaken payments, actually payments made pursuant to a trust. And in that case, Lord Walker said of the equitable jurisdiction to unwind the transaction that it turned on, and his word, I hate this word, unconscionableness, which he interpreted in an objective sense. He said you have regard to the circumstances of the mistake, the consequences, change of position, and other matters relevant to the exercise of the court's direction. Compare that with a case decided 2 weeks later, Vestergaard and Besnett, a case about breach of confidence, and the real issue in this case was whether the liability of the defendant was a liability as an accessory. And in that case, Lord Neuberger said that the accessory's liability again depended on conscience. It was arising in equity. But he interpreted conscience in a subjective sense, focusing on the defendant's state of mind and it encompasses issues of knowledge, willful blindness, recklessness, and dishonesty. So what we have within the space of 2 weeks, and Pitt and Holt decided first did not refer to Vestergaard, but Vestergaard made no reference to Pitt and Holt. There seemed to be no awareness that the language of conscience was being used, same words, completely different interpretations. Pitt and Holt, an objective notion of unconscionableness, having regard particularly to the judge's discretion, and Vestergaard, much more subjective, but focusing on fault. So what do we mean by conscience and unconscionability? Let me just clear the ground a little bit. For myself, I think we can use unconscionability and good conscience interchangeably in the sense that unconscionability means contrary to good conscience. It's just the negative sense of the positive concept of good conscience. And when you read the cases, and I should emphasize the cases I've been reading for this are English cases, Australian cases, and most definitely cases in New Zealand, you see synonyms for unconscionability. Words and phrases such as bad faith, equitable fraud, injustice, unfairness, dishonesty, and commercially unacceptable conduct. All those words and phrases conveying the idea of something against good conscience. So the question that I need to consider is whether unconscionability is a state of mind, or is it a normative standard for evaluating conduct, or is it a test of morality, or a sense of guilt, or even all of those things? That is what I hope to consider in this presentation. So in New Zealand, those ideas have sometimes been brought very closely together. Justice Summers in the Elders Pastoral case said, words such as unconscionable and inequitable have drawn closer to more objective concepts such as fair, reasonable and just. So perhaps suggesting in New Zealand moving away from the Vestergaard subjective fault notion to perhaps some rather more normative standard of conduct. And I just want to quote to you something from a book that some of you may have heard of called The Bramble Bush, written by Carl Llewellyn, who was an American professor who lectured for quite a long time at Columbia Law School to first-year law students. And the Bramble Bush was really a collection of his lectures to first-year law students, written in really flowery language. And he was certainly, in what I'm about to quote, not referring to conscience or unconscionability. But this sums up beautifully the nature of the problem. He said, legal use of technical words has sinned and does still in two respects. It is involved in ambiguity of two kinds: multiple senses of the same terms and terms too broad to be precise in application to details of single disputes. First, it does not use terms in single senses, but uses the same term in several senses, and in several senses indiscriminately without awareness. This invites confusion, it makes bad logic almost inevitable. It makes statement of clear thought difficult. It makes clear thought itself improbable. And I think that's the problem we have reached in England, and I think maybe in New Zealand, where we just use the language without pausing to think exactly what does it mean. So what does it mean? Let me give you a very brief history of conscience. Now, I'm going to preface what I'm about to say, that if any of you are legal historians, you are going to throw your arms up in the air about my gross simplification of the development of conscience. But it is a simplification, but I actually think that the five stages that I've identified in that slide, and I will talk about now, reflect the way conscience developed in England from the origins of equity. If you go right back to the early period of equity, it was the Chancellor's conscience, the Lord Chancellor, that constituted equity. And that meant that the judge who was in the position of the Chancellor had petitions presented to him, and it was always him, and crucially, for many years, he was also an archbishop and therefore was theologically trained, which I think is significant. And that judge then, by using his conscience, determined whether the petition should be allowed and what the nature of the remedy should be. So the origins of conscience can be identified in an individual moral judgment of one person, but that person was theologically trained. As equity developed, the language of conscience then focused very much on personal knowledge. And what that meant was, in trying to identify evidence in chancery equity cases, the only evidence that was relevant was what witnesses actually observed themselves. And that was referred to as their conscience. It was their conscience that constituted the evidence. So we can therefore see a shift to looking at the conscience of individual people other than the judge. The next stage in the development, and you can trace this and identify this in the 17th century, was a focus on conscience referring to the defendant's conscience, but a conscience as determined by the court. Here, equity had a cathartic jurisdiction. And in the very famous case, the Earl of Oxford's case in 1615, Lord Ellesmere specifically said the office of the Chancellor, the Lord Chancellor, is to correct men's conscience. Where the court considers the defendant had done something wrong, it was the function of equity to intervene and provide a remedy for petitioners because of the defendant's conscience being affected. Fourthly, the next stage in the development, the language of conscience and unconscionability was used to explain and structure the development of equitable doctrine. So we have another notion of conscience. What we now call the law of equity was framed in terms of conscience. But we can see there, not referring to the judge's conscience or a witness's conscience or the defendant's conscience, equity is conscience, is what the judges said. And finally, and I think this brings us up to date, there is the notion of conscience which I call rhetorical conscience. And I think this is the language of conscience that Lord Walker was using in Pitt and Holt. And all I mean by rhetorical conscience is judges just using the words of saying good conscience or unconscionability. but without any attempt to unpack what that might mean, and actually enabling the judge to hide behind that word or that phrase. And it really enables the judge then to say, well, I think this conduct is unconscionable, without needing to provide any further explanation, which I think is the real criticism of Pitt and Holt. Now, you could say, having looked at this very brief history of conscience, maybe we've gone full circle. Maybe this notion of rhetorical conscience goes right back to the Lord Chancellor's conscience, this idea of individual moral judgment. They look to be the same sort of thing. I don't think they are, because the Chancellor's conscience and the language of conscience there, as I said, was based on theological notions. There were principles and concepts that underpinned conscience there. And we don't see that now with rhetorical conscience. And that's a problem. So that said, that brings us up to the present day. How is conscience actually interpreted today by the courts? And what I've done, and there is quite a lot of research behind this that I'm not going to have time to go through, I've identified four contemporary interpretations of conscience. The first is subjective conscience of the defendant. This is what we can see in the Vestergaard case. We say conscience of the defendant can trigger a particular legal response having regard to the defendant's own mental state. And that's really using conscience as a synonym for fault, whether that is intention, knowledge, recklessness, willful blindness. And we see this in different parts of the law. Certainly there are cases in New Zealand and in England where this subjective conscience of the defendant is a trigger for the creation of equitable proprietary interests. That if, for example, there is a very famous English case involving money paid by mistake to the defendant, and the defendant knows that it was paid by mistake, that money can then be held on constructive trust for the claimant. An equitable proprietary interest is created, and it's created because of the defendant's mental state, subjective conscience. Secondly, there is objective conscience of the defendant, where the court says, we are saying, you defendant, your conscience has been affected because your conduct is unreasonable. We're not actually identifying a subjective mental state. It's using language of the reasonable person, an objective fault. And we see that in the equitable claim for dishonestly assisting a breach of trust, where dishonesty is interpreted objectively. And also in the jurisprudence in Australia, New Zealand, and England, where unconscionability can be used to unwind a contractual transaction. Now, the cases are in a complete mess, but I think the majority of them are focusing on an objective interpretation of unconscionability. But those first two senses are at least focusing on the defendant's conscience. A third sense has no regard to the defendant's state of mind, what the defendant was thinking or should have been thinking, but actually has regard to the court's conscience, justifying the equity court's intervention, but doing so by reference to recognised principles. Not just saying this is unconscionable, actually unpacking the law and saying these are the hallmarks of unconscionable conduct. And I think developing jurisprudence in proprietary estoppel is a really good example of that. But there is evidence of the court's conscience as a rhetorical device. As I've already said, I think that's Pitt and Holt just bunging in the language of unconscionability without any attempt to unpack it and explain what might be a hallmark of unconscionability. And in England, we had a period of time where the defence of illegality in private law claims, in equity but also in tort and contract as well, depended on whether the public conscience would be outraged by a remedy being provided. Now, although the word public was put in front, that really meant the judge's conscience, giving the judge free rein to determine whether or not a remedy should be awarded. So I think you can identify these four interpretations of conscience. It's that fourth one which I have real difficulty with. That is a discretionary approach to conscience. And here, I think, is the nub of the issue. To what extent is it appropriate to allow the judge to have a discretion to determine what is actually going on? That is a problem. I've just lost my slides. If I click on the screen.
Or use your finger on the screen.
I can carry on without, and I will carry on without.
Can you see that view?
Oh, it's come up. Oh, sorry. Okay, I didn't see it. So you can see it. I couldn't see it there. Okay, so I will move slightly and I'll read from there. So the crux of the problem is the extent to which we think the judge should be given discretion to reach the right result. I think there may, at this point, be a bit of a difference between what you do in New Zealand and what we do in England. Because my reading of New Zealand cases, and also my engagement with academics in law and judges and law students from New Zealand, suggests that you actually trust your judges an awful lot more than we do in England. Now, certainly if we go right back to Utopia, Thomas More actually engaged with this issue of judicial discretion. And he said the law and judges should avoid arcane interpretations and debates about law, but should instead judge the overall equity or justice of a situation and decide accordingly. Now, I've using that to really describe what I've called rhetorical conscience. There's no emphasis on principles there. That is saying the judge is the person who's in a position to look at all the facts and decide what the overall equity or justice of the case demands. But in England, as I say, we are rather more suspicious of the judges. And although the dictum from Lord Camden is from a case in 1795, I can imagine a number of judges still saying this, and certainly a lot of commentators saying this. Lord Camden said, "The discretion of the judge is the law of tyrants. It is always unknown. It is different in different men. It is casual and depends upon constitution, in temper and passion. In the best, it is oftentimes caprice. In the worst, it is every, that should say, vice, folly, and passion to which human nature is liable." and judges in England would reflect that sentiment, certainly senior judges, about the extent to which discretion can be regarded as valid. But I think it's a bit more complicated than that. When we look at discretion, what do we actually mean by discretion of the judge? Do we mean just letting the judge get on with it? Or do we mean we are expecting the judge to assess the facts, but with regard to the law? Now, in my preparation for this, I came across a paper written by the famous legal philosopher H.L.A. Hart, written actually in 1958 when he was on a visiting fellowship in Harvard Law School. And apparently he had been discussing with some academics in Harvard what is meant by discretion. And he gave a paper at a seminar and they suggested that he should write it up, which he did, but it wasn't published until 2013. And it's now published in the Harvard Law Review. It's a short paper simply entitled Discretion. And it really has influenced my thinking about conscience and unconscionability. Because essentially, simplifying the argument a bit, but essentially what Hart said was discretion is completely different from arbitrary choice. You can have a judge who is applying rules and has no choice. At the other extreme is the judge who simply determines on the facts what he or she wants the result to be. But he doesn't consider that to be discretion. Discretion is where the judge is given a choice as to the result. But it's not arbitrary. It's principled. There, and the law identifies the framework for legal thinking, giving the judge a choice, but structuring the judge's reasoning. And I've taken that idea to come up with what I somewhat arrogantly call a new taxonomy of conscience, which sounds clever, but actually it's just simplifying the law somewhat. And I think the right way to approach conscience is by saying it actually embodies three different concepts. The first two focus on the defendant's conscience. And we can see in loads of cases in England and in New Zealand using the defendant's conscience as a mark of liability. Sometimes that's a subjective test asking, what did that defendant think? What was that defendant's mental state? But also it is an objective test, assessing the defendant's conduct in the light of the facts as the defendant knew or believed them to be. Now, this is simplifying quite a lot of analysis of cases, but that second objective sense of conscience is where in England we've certainly reached with an awful lot of our law relating to conscience. That subjective test is very rare. It's the objective test, assessing, evaluating the defendant's conduct in the light of what the defendant knew or believed. That is the test. And actually, I think it might be appropriate to call that second objective test dishonesty. It's still founded on conscience, but it is a concept of dishonesty, which is a prime factor in identifying liability in various equitable claims. But conscience can also legitimately refer to the court's conscience, the judge's conscience. And I think it doesn't matter whether you call it the court or the judge. I think they can be used interchangeably. But this is discretion, this notion of the judge's conscience, but using discretion in a heart sense, a principled discretion, not like Pitt and Holt, where it's just the language of conscience, identifying underneath that what needs to be considered, structuring the judge's thinking. That is, I think, a legitimate use of conscience. So that is my structure for the law on conscience and unconscionability. Where does this take us? And I only have time to refer to three implications of what I've been talking about. The first I have been referring to a bit, the determination of fault in equitable claims. There are all sorts of equitable claims which involve a personal liability. For example, if you've received property in breach of trust, or you've assisted in a breach of trust, you can be personally liable, but equity says that requires proof of fault. It's not a strict liability claim. My contention is, and it is consistent with an awful lot of authority, not unanimous because the cases are in a real mess, but that notion of fault is properly analysed as unconscionability in its objective sense. And as I said earlier, I am very happy to call that dishonesty to mark it out. But dishonesty is an objective interpretation of conscience. Secondly, the role of conscience in unjust enrichment. Now, I could, at this point, keep you for another 3 hours to talk about the intricacies of the law of unjust enrichment. And I know there are drinks waiting us at the end of this, so I won't. But I do want to say a little bit about the developing law of unjust enrichment. Our modern law of unjust enrichment in England can be traced back to the 18th century and various cases, largely with judgments given by Lord Mansfield. And Lord Mansfield, in a lot of those cases, said, for example, if I pay money to you by mistake, I can get my money back because that is what conscience demands. He used the language of conscience to justify the modern, what we now call, the law of unjust enrichment. Interestingly, he said that in a famous case called Sadler and Evans, which actually is precisely 250 years old. So came after Utopia, we're up to the present day, Sadler and Evans is in the middle. But as the modern law of unjust enrichment has developed in England, the language of conscience has disappeared. And instead, we've replaced it with the language of unjust enrichment, essentially saying, if you have been enriched at my expense in circumstances where your enrichment is unjust, you've got to make restitution to me. And we recognise that, and this is another anniversary in England, in a case called Lipkin-Gorman, decided precisely 25 years ago. And of course, you have unjust enrichment in this country, a very well-developed body of law. Good for you. In Australia, things are a bit different. In Australia, for some time, Australian judges were doing very well in developing the law of unjust enrichment in a very principled way. But then recently, they've gone, arguably, completely off the rails because they have rejected unjust enrichment and instead specifically identify restitutionary liability, liability to give things back, by reference to conscience and unconscionability. Most recently, in the Australian Financial Services and Leasing and Hills Industries case, a decision of the High Court of Australia, where unjust enrichment was rejected, and specifically Chief Justice French said legal principles of restitution or unjust enrichment can be equated with seminal equitable notions of good conscience. But what interpretation of conscience is meant there? Is it the subjective fault of the defendant, or objective fault, or is it a principled notion of conscience, or is it rhetorical conscience, just using the word and then the judge hiding behind it? Now, in that case, the High Court of Australia says various things about conscience and unconscionability and say it's principled, but they don't identify the principles. They say it's founded on clear concepts, but they make no attempt to identify what those concepts are. And frankly, and I know I'm not in Australia, so I can probably speak frankly, I think they are really, really confused. They don't like this modern notion of unjust enrichment. They've gone back to where they thought the jurisdiction originated from. But they don't actually tell us what conscience and unconscionability means. Now, I am speculating a bit here. From what I'm saying, what they're doing in Australia seems completely at odds with what we are doing in England and in New Zealand with our law of unjust enrichment. But actually, when you start to think about it, I don't think we are that far apart. Because if you look at that Hills Industries case, which had slightly complicated facts, but was essentially a case about money being paid by mistake, the High Court of Australia said there was a liability to make restitution. And I think the same result would be reached in England and in New Zealand. There was quite a lot of discussion about defences, and arguably those defences would be interpreted in the same way as well. But I think the basic liability, the result, would be the same. And in Australia, they have to use the language of unconscionability. And if you ask them what makes it unconscionable in these circumstances, surely the answer is, well, this defendant received money, that money came from the plaintiff, and that money was paid by mistake, so it's appropriate for that defendant to pay the money back, subject to any defence of change of position. That's exactly how we'd analyse it in New Zealand and in England. And I have no doubt that's how the Australians would analyse it as well. So actually, I think this is a really good example. They haven't quite said this yet, where what purports to be rhetorical conscience is actually principled conscience, because it's founded on notions of unjust enrichment. And actually, that may provide a profound justification for the law of unjust enrichment, which is increasingly under challenge in New Zealand and in England as to what the theoretical justification for it might be. And I think we have to go back to Lord Mansfield and find that and realise it is based on conscience and unconscionability. You can't just say that. You've got to provide the structured reasons for legal thinking, which I think is what unjust enrichment does. And finally, other implications of my analysis of conscience I think are relevant to remedies, and I'm not going to look at breach of confidence or proprietary estoppel. But I do want to finish with the remedial constructive trust. You, as I've said, trust your judges. You have no problem in this country in recognising the remedial constructive trust, allowing the judge to determine on the facts that it is appropriate to recognise an equitable proprietary interest. In England, we don't have the remedial constructive trust. It's discretionary. We don't like it. And I can tell you that last week in England, in our Supreme Court, one of the justices speaking for the court in a case specifically said that the remedial constructive trust is not recognised in England. He said, English law is generally averse to the discretionary adjustment of property rights and has not recognised the remedial constructive trust, which is favoured in some other jurisdictions. Now, the reason for that probably comes down to the suspicion of judges in England, whereas you have more confidence about your judiciary, that they are going to do it right. But I think that an English approach and a New Zealand approach as regards the constructive trust can be brought much closer together. It seems to be two extremes. We have rules for the constructive trust, you have discretion. But in a number of cases in this jurisdiction concerning the remedial constructive trust, the language of unconscionability is often used, but the judge is interpreting it in a principled sense, having regard to the implications of recognising a constructive trust for all the parties in the case, and identifying principles to explain that discretion. So certainly in New Zealand, the remedial constructive trust fits in that principled notion of conscience. I think in England, and this recent Supreme Court case means it's more difficult to argue this, but I don't think it's a big step for England to give the judge discretion as regards the constructive trust because it must be principled. And immediately you say it's principled, there are reasons underpinning it that have to be identified to influence the judge's discretion, suddenly it becomes defensible. And therefore, that is a perfect example of where England has an awful lot to learn from what you do in New Zealand. I think your approach to the constructive trust is absolutely right. So finally, what are my conclusions? First, I think when we answer the question, what do we mean by conscience and unconscionability, we need to distinguish between the conscience of the defendant and the conscience of the court. The conscience of the defendant is a test of fault, which I think is generally assessed objectively. The subjective assessment of fault is present, but is only present very exceptionally, and probably only as regards the recognition and creation of proprietary rights. And it is legitimate to refer to the conscience of the court, but not in that rhetorical sense, but in a principled way. And I want to finish with another quotation from Carl Llewellyn's Bramble Bush. When I read this, I thought, this is spot on as to how judges should approach conscience. Llewellyn says, unless the appellate courts consciously awaken to what their duty is in this regard, they are threatened with loss of their own souls, and we are threatened with loss of the greatest asset of the common law. Every opinion must be directed forward. It must make sense and give guidance for tomorrow for the type of situation in hand. Only in the light of that are the equities and decencies of the particular case to be attended to. For in the working out of that forward-looking guidance, two things occur. First, the authoritative material at hand to work with exercises in due restraint. And that gives a court firmness of heart and rock solidity of work. Second, no pressure of the particular case can readily mislead into sentimentality when all is judged against right guidance through the type of situation for the future. That, as I said, rather flowery language, but that I think is a good summary of what I think principled discretion founded on conscience actually means. And when you focus on that, suddenly equity becomes much more defensible, much more consistent with the rule of law. And actually, despite Thomas More's acceptance of arguably rhetorical conscience, I think makes equity the utopia for the future. Thank you.